Couldn't orient to it. It always startled her. It was really hard. And the only thing that fixed it for her was the dryer. Remember that? Yeah. But the problem is then the woman had to get up every 2 hours to turn the dryer back on again. So somebody wasn't going to get any sleep. It could be her, or it could be the dog. Okay, so habituation can have spontaneous recovery. I have not seen this happen very often, but if the sound of the freeway changed, the reaction of the dog could go back to level 1, and the process, or like level 10, and the process would have to start all over again. But again, I haven't really seen that happen very often. It's more likely that it never was totally habituated to begin with. And if you do have to start the process over again, it's going to be much faster. So if I have a new puppy, a new dog, I'm really going to be trying to habituate it to almost everything that I can. And habituation doesn't require that the dog interact with anybody. It's just kind of has to be there, you know, and it's just observing or whatever. So sometimes a dog will sensitize rather than habituate. So if you do this wrong, say you're, we'll just use this one. If you moved a dog close to a firing range, then gunshots would occur throughout the day. Perhaps the dog would habituate to the gunshots. It's quite possible. Or it might also become ultra sensitive and reactive to the sound. And that's that whole, I can't orient to it and it's coming out of nowhere. That, you know, that it's a sound that's a very startling sound. So I would probably be considering habituation whenever something is fairly consistent, you know, as opposed to just every once in a while. Okay. So thunder phobia is something that can come on over time. Older dogs are much more prone to be sensitive to the sound of thunder than our younger dogs. Can anybody tell me why that might be? Why? But around about the age of 8, you get a bunch of dogs that suddenly get really thunder phobic.
Because of their
hearing. What?
Their hearing.
Yes.
Changes.
Yeah, their hearing changes. They a lot of times what happens is they can no longer hear the whole range that they heard before, so they may only be hearing the top range or the bottom range. And things are much quieter for them. And so they get that startle effect, much more so than they ordinarily would. But yeah, their hearing changes. We have to remember the physicality of this kind of thing, you know. So they can, and so you cannot, probably you're going to be less likely to modify the behavior of a dog that's got a hearing change. I told you about my dog Strider, right, who had... Who was very sensitive to sounds. He was a German Shepherd. And then he got a foxtail, and they gave him some antibiotics, and he went deaf. And it was very nice. Because he was deaf. Because he'd race through the house. We have a fairly small house, and here's this big dog racing through it whenever he hears something. You know, so one of my clients yesterday, the woman with the 10-year-old cocker, she said there is a bunch of antibiotics that cause deafness in people too. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And I said, what kind are they? And she said, they're broad spectrum. They're the oldest antibiotics. They don't use them very much anymore. But every once in a while they do, and they don't know what the percentage of animals or people will become deaf. They find out when the animal or person becomes deaf. That's how they find out. And I'm like, oh my God, and they don't tell you. They don't say, by the way, one of the side effects is deafness. You know? And the Strider's hearing never came fully back. He was always much, much calmer as an individual after that. He, you know, he didn't, I mean, he was a normal German Shepherd. Oh my God, what is that? I'm sure it's gonna kill me. The German Shepherds. Some dogs can sensitize to the clicker. In fact, Strider is sensitized to the clicker. If you use the clicker wrong, because clickers are, you know, how many of you guys use clicker training? Anybody?
Sometimes.
Yeah, so that's a pretty, most of them have that pretty strong sound, and they can actually sensitize to it, and it can send them away instead of thinking that they get treats, they actually do the opposite. So that can happen. So if you're training or consulting with clients, you'd worry about sensitization because it happens. Okay. All right, now here we get to the tough stuff. Any questions about those fun ways of learning? Okay, so classical conditioning. Classical conditioning is used all the time. Anybody heard of Jean Donaldson? She is a classical conditioning queen. She really, really likes classical conditioning. And I don't. I use it sometimes, but I don't tend to use it a whole lot. But it does have its virtues for sure. So the dog learns that certain things occur together. Okay, an association is formed without the dog doing anything to make the association occur. So I don't know if you remember back in the video that I played earlier, I was doing some classical conditioning with a boxer. And the boxer was just lying on the pavilion floor. And I was approaching with a dog that this dog had already been growling at, the stuffed dog. And just very, very slowly approaching the dog. The boxer didn't need to do anything. I was doing everything, and the owner was just kind of standing there as well. Now, you can add, counter conditioning to it, and that usually makes it more powerful, which we'll talk about again in a second. So this is where it came from. This is Pavlov, right? The original relationship I've left out a slide here, but it was Pavlov, and he was trying to he was actually examining the salivary reflex in dogs. So that's why he was working with dogs. So what would happen is he would put some meat powder on the dog's tongue and the dog would salivate, and that's what he was studying. But after a while, what he noticed was that when they were getting the dogs ready to get tested, and they were putting the harness on the dog, the dogs would start to salivate. So it was before there was any kind of meat powder in the picture. So the dogs were starting to associate the harness being put on with good things going to happen. They were going to get some meat powder, so they were starting to salivate. So when you put the meat powder on his tongue, and it caused that reflex of the salivation. So that's a reflex, right? They don't have any control over that. That is called an unconditioned response. That is just what happens when you put meat powder on a dog's tongue. They start to salivate. But the harness, and if they had the dog started salivating when the harness went on, that is called an unconditioned reinforcer, a conditioned response rather. So that is, it is what they've done is they've conditioned it to have an effect on the dog. So that's what that whole thing is. So, looks like this. You guys have this in your handout, right? Okay. And I have one where it says, I guess I didn't have it in here. That Pavlov's dog is conditioned Pavlov to every time I drool, he goes, aha, and writes in his butt. So, you know, okay. So what happens with classical conditioning is that you can change emotional states through classical conditioning. So when you're thinking about using classical conditioning, it's almost always to change the emotion of a dog. You're not actually changing the behavior because the dog isn't doing anything behaviorally. He's just sitting there. And so if indeed you ever take the test, you have to take my test or you take the test for the CPDT, you'll need to know that this is what is involved, is conditioned reinforcement and, you know, what is classical conditioning and what is operant conditioning. So what happened in the 1920s with John Watson is that a little boy was shown a neutral stimulus, which is a white rat, which he liked, actually, and he found it quite interesting. But every time after the first time he was exposed to the rat, it was accompanied by a nasty noise, and apparently it was a really gross, horrible noise, and it scared the child. So after a while, what would happen is the child would see the rat and get scared without the noise. So we got the conditioned reinforcer and the unconditioned reinforcer. So let's think about things in the dog's world. What happens when you open the refrigerator right around the time the dogs usually eat? Yeah, so I know that our dogs don't have very much to do, right? So So they're going to watch you, and if it gets to be about that time, they're going to go, oh, look, she's just getting up. I bet that means that, you know, food time is coming. In our house, they do a happy dance. Flocka and Heather start to roll around on the floor and playing with balls and squeakies. Aspen goes and sits in her crate like this. And Luke, poor Luke, you go, you know, when I'm getting ready, he knows that the food is coming, so he comes over and goes. And you go, Luke, go sit over there. And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. For 12 years, you've had to go sit over there. I don't think I knew that. I don't know what you're talking about. So you end up going, come on, Luke, come on over here. Good. Sit. Stay. Got that? Got it. Good. There he is. Here. Go back over. Sit. Stay. Good boy. Aww. 12 years of doing this. He's pretty. Certainly not the brightest. Okay, so, and what else might you, what might you have conditioned?
A leash,
as soon as you pull out the leash.
As soon as you put your tennis shoes or your back chain.
Anything where you know you've got a dog with separation anxiety, they back chain everything, right?
The jingling of the house keys.
The jingling of the house keys, yeah.
Going potty when you come home, run to the back door.
Run to the back door? That's actually a really good one. Yeah. Anybody else? What else?
Cheese wrappers.
Yeah, just
a little tiny black bag.
Yeah. Yeah. That can do it. She goes, I woke up. Yeah. So you have actually been programming your dog, and your dog has been programming you all the way through the dog's whole life. And you have not required, so none of those things require any overt action on the part of the dog, right? So this is why it can be very powerful. And you may be classically conditioning things that you have no idea you're classically conditioning. I have one friend who has a dog who is, he is very possessive. He's got resource guarding. And she gets when she opens the refrigerator door, he runs to the door and bites her. So this is not what you really want to do from classical conditioning, but that's, you know, and she, of course it's a little dog, so she thinks it's funny. And I keep going, you know, I don't think it's funny because I think it's going to do that to somebody and they're not going to like it. And, you know, but. So if you're trying to work on something, using classical conditioning, you would do systematic desensitization and classical counter conditioning. So a really common thing that people use classical conditioning for would be like dog aggression. So if you've ever heard of Cat, conditional aggression training, it's Cat. All right, I'll think of it later. But anyway, they often use classical conditioning. So if you have a dog that is very afraid of, let's just say he's very afraid of men, okay? And so you have the dog lying down, and so you bring a man in, and the dog is just lying down. He doesn't have to do anything. In fact, he can get up because you're not requiring him to do anything. And as the guy is presented, then you classically condition by giving the dog a treat. And this, and we've all seen this. You've seen this over and over and over again. And people sometimes use it ad nauseum, and sometimes people use it right, and sometimes they use it wrong. So then what happens over a period of time is the guy can get closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. And the association is created between the guy and the dog. So the dog thinks, oh, guy means treat for me, that's nice, this is really great. So I might use this in conjunction with operant conditioning if I'm working with a dog that has some leash reactivity to other dogs, because I may give the dog a treat even though he has done nothing. It's very rare that I do that. When we were first taught this, I remember people saying, the dolphin trainers were saying, you can't go wrong with this thing. You can go wrong with this. You can be actually reinforcing a state of mind that you don't want to be reinforcing. So if he's thinking naughty thoughts and you're giving him treats, so you're reinforcing a dog that's thinking naughty thoughts. If you're reinforcing, if he's very relaxed, you're reinforcing relaxation. So that's one reason why I tend to be worried about classical conditioning, because what the behaviorists say, and this is the Skinner and the Skinner people, they say, you know, it's you don't look at the emotions, you look at the behavior. It's the behavior. But the way I look at things, I look at the emotion. And so I don't want to be reinforcing the wrong emotion. So that's why I do that. But that's not to say that you couldn't or wouldn't or shouldn't. You know, it's just that that's what I found out. Now, the thing about classical conditioning and desensitization is that it's really easy to talk about. Obviously, you know, we talk about it in 5 minutes, it's done. It's really hard to implement. So say you have a dog that's got, is afraid of little kids. So now you're gonna have to go find a school or something and sit outside the school with your dog and just pretend to be just kind of hanging around. And every time a kid goes by, you're gonna give the dog a treat. And you cannot do it at the level where the dog is aroused, because if you do that, then you're actually probably gonna be reinforcing the wrong behavior. So you have to figure out exactly where you're gonna be. And then you kind of go slowly closer and closer and closer. Wouldn't habituation be better here? Where you're just gonna be, you know, it's 20 feet away and you just kind of get the dog used to it. And you can be given an habituation, you can give the dog a treat every once in a while. It's just not associated with the children necessarily. So to me, just trying to get closer and closer and closer to kids, especially because you get spontaneous recovery so easily. You get about, you know, 15 feet and all of a sudden the dog is like, there's children there! And then they get exploded, they explode, and then all of a sudden you got to go back to 25 feet again. So it can become far more complex than you think it's going to be, because it's such a simple procedure. It's just that what the dog is learning may not be what we're teaching. That makes sense to you. So Strider, this is Strider sleeping. He obviously got very bored with the whole, you know, desensitization kind of thing. But he had separation anxiety and leash reactivity. I'm trying to think what I worked with. It's all operant. Everything I did with him was operant.
You said you were his seventh home?
We were seventh home, yeah. He, you know, but you can see that he coped fine. Actually, he's a really, really good example of a stable dog. Once he actually got into a home and had the rules that he needed to get by, he calmed down and he became wonderful. That does not happen very often. Most of the time, a dog that's gone through seven different homes, they have a hard time figuring out they're really going to stay at the last place. The only disappointment that I think Strider ever had was the fact that I was a girl. He loved men. And my ex-husband thought he was a cool dog, but he never did any training or anything, you know. But Strider would go up to every guy going, take me away from this bitch. He was just such a great dog. So, yeah. So classical conditioning with classical conditioning with desensitization. The reactive dog sits beside the owner. Another dog is brought in at a tolerable level. The subject dog remains relaxed. Immediately after the second dog is brought in, the subject dog is fed. The subject dog does not have to do anything to be fed. So this is what the way they the when I was learning it, this is what they said you were supposed to do. You do not give the dog the treat before the other dog gets in. You do it after the dog is in. And I completely turn that around. Because a lot of times I find that if you're going to use this kind of thing, then you give the dog a taster and say, this is what you're going to earn. And so you give him one before, and then you give him one after the other dog is in there. I have no problem whatsoever in bribing dogs. Yes.
Just whatever they're doing.
That's why I don't use it. Okay? Because you might be reinforcing that state of mind. You know? But if you go to somebody who really, really likes classical conditioning, they say it does not matter what the subject dog is doing, you still reinforce. And to me, I have seen that backfire too many times. I don't like it. And so I add more criteria in there. It's not that I won't use the thing, I'm just going to probably go operant, which is meaning to say the dog actually has to do something. So, yeah.
Do When you're doing classical conditioning for a dog, let's say that's very reactive, but they're not, let's say they're not reacting and you're just giving them really high value treats, is this something, like, if your dog's older, you're like, they don't need to meet other dogs, but I do want them to be okay walking, if they're okay walking down the street, as long as they're not too close. You just do that forever for their whole life, classical? Like, what do you, so you were talking about, I forget what you said earlier, but do you just continue to do that? Or they don't like people, so they get a treat. They know they get a treat, they don't react. Do you just do that?
Well, if you're doing it operantly, in other words, you're giving them a treat when they respond appropriately, yeah, as opposed to just not respond at all. I mean, just...
Like they just see a person.
Yeah, and then they look back at you and get a treat.
Yeah.
That can be operant because they are looking at something that's afraid and now they're looking back at you. Then what you do is you go to what we'll be talking about a little bit later, which is, you know, intermittent reinforcement, which ends up being a little bit more powerful. And that's... Intermittent reinforcement just built on anticipation. So again, we will get to that because we're going to be talking a lot about that. So when I'm doing it, if I do classical conditioning, and when I first wrote this a long time ago, I was doing more classical conditioning. I would start to feed the subject dog before the second dog was brought in. We did this in difficult dog classes. So what we would do is each of the dogs that were the reactive dogs was in its own pod, shall we say, and we'd bring a stuffed dog by, because most of the dogs were dog reactive. So the person would start to feed the dog, their dog, and then I'd walk by with a stupid stuffed dog. And so the dog would start to get fed before I walked by, keep getting fed as I walked by, and as soon as I left, stop eating. So we're identifying the food with the scary object, but at the same time, I didn't want to start it after they'd gone by because I wanted to see if I could help the dog stay relaxed all the way through. I didn't want them to start going blowing and then getting treats. I wanted to try to so under the hard and fast rules of scientific classical conditioning, that's wrong. You should be doing it, what I should be doing is walking with my stepdog, and now he can see it, now we're gonna start going treat, 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 stop. Okay, so that window should be pretty, you know, pretty definitive. When you start when you hit the window and you end when you're done with it. But I would do it differently, and I found that it worked better. So.
Wouldn't the dog be on here? The traditional way?
Yes, because they're already seeing the other dog. And the other thing is that given who dogs are, they know the dog is there because they're smelling them coming and they're hearing them coming. So just because they cannot officially see them because you're just walking to the pod, that doesn't mean that they're not aware that they're there. They also have great senses. They just are able to sense things much better than we can. So, you even could maybe say that was traditional counter conditioning if we assume that it's done at the time that the dog begins to notice that there's another dog coming by. Because I would do it with a stuffed dog at, you know, here's my reactive dog. I'm walking by with a stuffed dog, stuffed dog, stuffed dog, stuffed dog. Real dog, real dog, real dog, real dog. So, you know, and then another real dog, and then another real dog. So, you know, it is the other thing about classical conditioning, about any type of work with reactive dogs, is you can't just use one dog, you know. So you might think you can, but you can't. So, all right. So essentially what you're trying to do is work at the dog's, try to keep the dog relaxed. Right? So that's where you're working. Because if you get too close, then the dog isn't learning. If you get too far away, then you're just wasting your time. So again, dogs are always learning whether we are teaching them or not. Okay, so let's see. Any other questions about classical conditioning before we get into operant? Any other questions about any of the other kinds of learning? All the fun learning types. Okay. All right, so operant conditioning. Operant conditioning is unnecessarily complicated. I mean, you know, I guess I have my opinion about this, but I think that it is It has been parsed so much that we forget a lot of the holistic areas of it. So, you know, it is, but it is really important to know about it. So anyway, in operant conditioning, the dog's behavior operates on the dog's world. So if you want to know the difference between operant and classical, you just ask yourself the question, is the dog having to do something? If the dog has to do something, it's operant. Whether it's look at you or sit or down or whatever it might be, it's operant. So that's what operant conditioning is, but it always follows a specific sequence, and that sequence is antecedent, behavior, consequence, the ABCs of operant conditioning. Antecedent was probably chosen because we've got the letter A in it. Essentially, it means environment, you know? More than anything else, it means environment. So you could say environment, behavior, and consequence. So this is the B.F. Skinner, and there are still people who are B.F. Skinner advocates. He actually, from what I understand, was not a very nice person. He did not treat his family well. He thought of everybody as being subjects, and he did not like emotions. He really wanted to work his way away from emotions. And he's the person who did stuff with the rats, you know, the Skinner box. So antecedents, think of environment, they're the variables that can influence behavior. So all those variables are pretty important. There's the stimuli, things that are going on in the environment. And remember what we talked about in the first hour, right? Everything that's going on in the environment, they are seeing everything or hearing or feeling everything that's going on in the environment. Their previous conditioning history. So whatever kind of training they had before is going to stick with them. They're not blank slates. And if you're working with a dog that has some poor experiences, that's going to have a great deal to do with their response to your training. Establishing factors like, is the dog hungry? That's a big one. So you're teaching a class, right? And you tell the people in your class, don't give your dog breakfast. And they give the dog breakfast anyway. And the dog comes in, they say, my dog doesn't like treats. And first of all, they're trying to give the dog kibble as treats. And secondly, it's very common. And secondly, they are, you know, the dog ate breakfast, so it's not hungry. So you cannot bribe a millionaire. Well, you can. Apparently, you can bribe them a lot. But so I probably should stop saying that. You know, it is. But bribery, it would, if the dog doesn't want it, how on earth are you going to make him want it? And this whole thing about treats is so interesting to me because of the moral stuff that goes along with it. So it's as though they think that if they raise the value of the treat, there's something wrong with them, or there's something wrong with the dog. Anybody else get that? When you teach classes, you really see this, that they don't want to give something that's like pieces of cheese or burger or something like that because, my God, it's just a dog. Which is just so totally strange. I mean, we don't eat meat, but we give our dogs, you know, meat. They get whatever they need to make them do stuff. So if the dog is sick, it's going to have a huge impact on their behavior. If it's hot outside, I used to tell people with reactive dogs, go for a walk in the heat of the day. Because the dog's going to go, I would bark at you, but I'm really too hot. Right? So the amount of danger that's in the air, that they think is in the air, is going to have a huge impact. Because if an animal is fearful, they're not going to be able to learn. Their fight-flight instinct has been activated, and they're not with you mentally. They're someplace else entirely. So the antecedent, when I first started learning this, I thought, I just almost skipped antecedent. I thought, yeah. And now everything is about antecedent. Everything is about what's going on in the environment, what's going on in the dog's head that can help my dog learn or hinder the dog's learning. It's amazing how, I mean, I learned all this stuff years and years and years ago, and every once in a while I come back to it and I go, oh my God, you know, I was looking at it from the wrong end of the stick. And I just have to flip the way I'm looking at it again. That is, I mean, what somebody said to me today, the day you stop learning is the day you should die. You know, you just should keep on learning until you keel over. So B is for behavior. Behavior is anything the animal does. Anything the animal does is behavior. So, but for our purposes, we break complex behavior into very precise desired responses. So if you're talking about trying to teach a behavior, what people say when they want to teach here's a good one. They want to teach a recall, right? I want my dog to come to me. Why doesn't my dog come to you? My first question is, do they like you? Kind of a big one right there. I want my dog to come to me. And then we go, okay, we have to break this down into behaviors because this is not just one behavior. And if you think about what a come is, it is, if the dog is far away from you, it is stop, turn around, and come back. So that's three distinct behaviors that the dog has to learn before they can learn a recall. And yet people think of that as being one behavior because it ends up being one behavior. But it is, so for instance, if I have a dog, if I'm working with a dog that won't come, and it's like an off-leash thing, I don't even work on come. I work on stop. Stop, 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 stop. And then the dog eventually ends up just stopping in place, and then I work on come. Because you've got those three different behaviors you're working on. And it actually is a lot of fun. It's much, much easier to teach that because the dogs have no problem with stopping. They just don't want to come back to you. We don't want to do it either, you know. What? What do you want? You know, catch up with me. Okay, so, and C is for consequence. Each behavior has a consequence. Now, when I say consequence, do you guys think bad consequence? Or do you think good consequence? Or anything? You just think consequence, right? An enormous number of people think consequence means bad consequence. You say, there's got to be a consequence to this, and they think you mean a punishment. So, but a consequence is anything that happens to the dog after the behavior. So if he goes to sleep after the behavior, that's a consequence. If he falls off a cliff, that's a consequence. If he comes to you and sits, that's also a consequence. So behaviors either strengthen or weaken. And so then we get into the four quadrants. So reinforcement increases the behavior, whether it's a behavior you want or a behavior you don't want. So what are some reinforcements for you? Yeah, I mean, you know, you're here right now. Is this reinforcing for you right now?
Yeah,
so it hopefully it is. If it's a poor consequence, I'm sorry, But so we do things for the consequence as well. It's just that we don't think of it in those terms because we're doing things for fulfillment. We don't think of them as being consequences necessarily. Going to work is a behavior. And the consequence is getting paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a long-term consequence to a behavior. And the antecedent is, I'm going to be out of a house if I don't make some money and get some, and be able to pay the rent or be able to pay the mortgage. Punishment weakens the behavior it follows, and it suppresses it. And the current thought in the scientific world is that it does not extinguish the behavior. All right, so it weakens or suppresses the behavior, but it does not extinguish it. If you ever listen to Gary Wilkes, he will completely and absolutely disagree with this. He's a punishment fiend, I think. And he believes that it extinguishes the behavior. And I think it can extinguish a behavior. I think most of the time it suppresses it. So our dog, the one I was talking about yesterday, that I saw yesterday, the pit bull, they were using the e-collar and the pinch collar on the dog, right? And it wasn't working. It was suppressing the behavior. You could actually walk around other dogs without the dog trying to kill the other dog. But if he had let the leash loose, what would have happened? He would have gone after the dog, and he did go after some people. So that's what we mean by suppressing or weakening the behavior. Most people, lay people, think of punishment as actually extinguishing behavior, getting rid of the behavior. And that's because in our world, what happens is people will stop doing something because of punishment while the other person's around. Yeah? Same thing happens in the dog world. I always get a kick out of it. Well, I kick him off the couch every time I come home. And as soon as you go away, he goes back on the couch. So now he jumps off the couch. As soon as he goes, oh, I hear the car. I guess I get off the couch now. So you have punished the behavior and you've suppressed it, but you have not extinguished it because as soon as you're gone, it comes back. And that's what happens with most punishment. But I actually do want to talk, not right now, about punishment a lot because there is so much of it in the environment and there's so much that needs to be said about it that is not said about it. So punishment essentially weakens the behavior. And extinction is the weakening of a previously reinforced response when it is no longer reinforced. It is this is not my verbiage. This is a scientist who says it is the surest, most humane way to eliminate a behavior. The behavior disappears, except it can come back. So here's a good one on that. All right, my dog, not my dog, but just pretend, my dog begs at the table. And every once in a while, I drop food or sneak a little under here. When I was growing up, you know, I had 11 brothers and sisters, and we had our dog named Mike. And when we ate dinner, Mike was under the table because Mike got all the food under the table because anything we didn't want, Mike got. My mom was kept on going, why is Mike getting so fat? You know, because one of my brothers gave him peas and Mike would even eat peas, you know, so he would eat and they were awful peas. They were canned peas. Blech. Anyway, none of us liked it. So say you have a situation where somebody in the family is giving the dog treats and the dog is begging. And finally, he or she, it's usually a he, is convinced not to do that. You know, if you don't want the dog to beg, then you can't give him any food. So he goes, okay, I'll do it. I won't give the dog any more food from the table. So he doesn't. And over a period of weeks and then months, the dog finally gets discouraged and moves away and doesn't come under the table anymore and no longer begs. So that behavior is called extinguished, right? It is no longer there. He lies on the bed, he doesn't get anything, he's okay. What is going to happen if the husband, in this case, goes, oh, he's so good, I'm just gonna give him one. Yeah, now you got spontaneous recovery, and will that ever go away now? No, that is absolutely the end. That is what intermittent reinforcement is all about. Is now the dog is going to live in hope that, well, one time it happened, I'm sure it can happen again. That's aspen at a gopher hole. Yeah? It happened once. A gopher stuck its head out of that gopher hole one time. I'm going to stay here forever until it happens again. So that is, you know, that's the problem with extinction. Because it if you're not careful, it can come back. So all behavior is driven by its consequences. And sometimes by the anticipation of consequences. This is what I added to their thing. So, and this is, that says on the bottom, it says, the bone is not the reward. Digging for the bone is the reward. And that's true, you know? So anticipation is part of that whole thing. Okay, so here we go. Positive reinforcement. You all have this one? Okay, this is from Sophia Yin, I believe. Sophia Yin had one like very much like this. If you want to know about this kind of stuff and you're interested, Sophia, even though Sophia's dead, her website's active, and she's got tons and tons of stuff on this.
What is
Sophia Yin, Y-I-N. She was I remember her well because she used to assist me during my aggressive dog classes, and then she went on to become one of the best veterinary behaviorists. Well, actually, she was a veterinarian and a behaviorist. She was not a veterinary behaviorist. And she killed herself a couple of years ago. But her site, as far as I know, is still active.
It is.
It's still really good.
It is. Yes. I've got material. I happened to see her, a month before she committed suicide.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised when I heard.
Yeah, she's a great person. Really, really a great person. She must have been having some pretty severe personal problems. That's all I don't know.
I think it's Cattle Dog Publishing, right?
Yeah.
Cattle Dog Publishing. Yeah, she actually came to me because she had a cattle dog that was aggressive. Duh.
There you go.
It's like, okay, you have a cattle dog. I mean, they are, they're great dogs, but they can be, they get opinionated. So if you can teach your dog not to be opinionated, you're good. And I love cattle dogs.
I'll bring her over.
Yeah. I adore cattle dogs. If only they didn't bark the way they bark. But, you know, it's bad enough having that. She's got some great information on her website. So positive reinforcement is adding good stuff to increase a behavior. So if you're talking about walking on a leash, then when the dog is walking appropriately on the leash, you tell the dog how wonderful he or she is, and then you give him some reinforcement, right? That's positive reinforcement. And reinforcement can be, oh, goody, you're a wonderful dog. It can be petting, just not on the top of their head, thank you very much. Or it can be treats. It can be anything. Reinforcement does not have to be treats. It can be a ball. It can be whatever you want. The reason we use treats in reinforcing is because they're easy and they're a primary reinforcer, because a dog needs food to eat, to live, you know, so it's good. So positive punishment, which is a misnamer, I mean, because we think of punishment as being something bad, and there we are saying positive, but this is the way it is. So positive punishment is adding bad stuff to decrease a behavior. So if the dog is pulling on the leash, you yank on the leash, that's a punishment, and the dog doesn't pull, except most dogs continue to pull, but just presume that the dog stops pulling, and then, you know, you have now punished the behavior, and the behavior is suppressed. Negative punishment, this one down here, delaying good stuff to decrease a behavior. So you don't pull. Essentially, the dog is pulling, so what you're trying to do is stop the dog from pulling, so you just stand still, and the dog comes back to you and doesn't pull, and that doesn't work. Not very well, anyway. It can work with some dogs who are very sensitive and wonderful. And then negative reinforcement, which delays bad stuff to increase the behavior. So what he says is that they move on a loose leash walking, you know, delay a leash pop, if you're going to do a leash pop, and that is negative reinforcement. The ones that I don't use at all is negative punishment. I very rarely use negative punishment. Or if I do, I don't think about what it is. Okay, so this is a fun thing I found. Okay, this is the current crop of positive trainers. Positive reinforcement. Super happy, yay, fun time, great. Positive punishment, literally Satan and also probably Hitler. Negative reinforcement, R minus, also Satan. Negative punishment, Satan light. So what we have right now are people who don't want to use all four quadrants a lot of times, and they are all useful. And I think that they are all really worth, no matter what kind of trainer you are, they're really worth knowing what you're doing when you're doing it, so that you can be saying to somebody, I don't use this because, or I do use this because I think that those are really important. And I do find, by the way, you know, because I deal with a lot of people who have been training dogs using generally positive punishment, and it's like with the people with the pinch collar, and I said, well, yeah, pinch collar is not a bad thing. If you know what you're talking about, if you're well grounded in what you're talking about, you can actually help people learn to go a much lighter and more pleasant route. So if think in terms of pleasant and unpleasant. So positive reinforcement, the behavior increases. Negative reinforcement, the behavior increases. Positive punishment, behavior decreases, and negative punishment, the behavior decreases. And if you take my test, you will not have to think about this stuff. Not much. A little tiny bit. So by giving a dog a treat when he sits, you increase the likelihood that he'll sit the next time you cue him. That's positive reinforcement. If you jerk on a leash when your dog pulls, you decrease the likelihood that he'll do it again. Negative reinforcement is pleasant. Okay, so that's what I was trying to say. Positive reinforcement is pleasant. Positive punishment is unpleasant. Negative reinforcement is pleasant. So here I am, I'm walking a dog. I've got the dog here. I pop the leash, right? And that's positive punishment. The leash lets go. That's negative reinforcement. So positive punishment is always followed by negative reinforcement. Almost always followed by negative reinforcement. So that is supposedly going to increase the likelihood that he'll not pull again. So a handler jerks on the leash, the dog receives positive punishment. The handler releases pressure on the leash, the dog receives negative reinforcement. This is what I liked. So dog pulls on the leash, the human receives positive punishment. That's why I did that. Okay, so who's getting the punishment? Who's getting this all right? Dog pulls on the leash, the human receives positive punishment. The dog releases pressure on the leash, the human receives negative reinforcement. Because leash pulling is not the dog doing something to the people. It is the dog trying to do something. Okay, I'm going to stop that. Go away. Okay, so for our purposes in training, the consequence is the reward. Therefore, the reward must be rewarding to the dog. And it can't be kibble or sometimes. Food is usually the reward of choice, but play can be a valuable reward, and life rewards can be excellent rewards. So a life reward would be something like doing a wait and then going through the door. That's a life reward. That's a really great one. And these are the best kinds of rewards. You know, anything that the dog is now allowed to do what he or she wants to do, those are all great rewards. They're what the dog should do. So most behavior changes are a combination of classical and operant conditioning, and they are all very, very messy because, as I showed in the video in the beginning, you're going to have a lot of different, it's going to fade from one kind of training to another kind of training. And it is really important for you just to know that this is the kind of training you use. You don't have to name it or anything, but to be really clear about this is what I'm trying to do to get that kind of response. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to get at here. Okay, that's pretty bad. Okay, can emotions be operantly conditioned? Can you train emotions? Trainers warn clients not to reassure a dog who is fearful because they will become more fearful in order to earn reinforcement. Do you think that happens?
I was with a trainer that said not to reward a fearful dog, but then recently I went to another trainer where I wasn't like paying attention to his fearfulness, and she was like, you can reassure him, it's okay.
Yeah.
It was a different experience for me.
Right.
Because I've been told not to.
Right. The idea is that if you reinforce that, then the dog will become more fearful. Mm-hmm. But if you're really scared and I put my arm around you, does that make you more frightened? If I comfort a child, does that make them more or less frightened? And generally speaking, it actually makes them less frightened. Mm-hmm. So my personal theory about this whole idea is that most of what we consider modern training came from military training in World War II. So because if you look at the different kinds of training, if you look at herding, they don't use sit down, come stay, heel. You know, they have words that have two syllables in them. You know, they actually talk to their dogs. They communicate with their dogs. But in military style training, it's very much like the military, you know, with humans. Everything is very abrupt. Everything is very quick. And it is, you have to do it at the very first time. So if I were a soldier in war, this would be a good thing. Somebody say, ready, aim, fire, you're supposed to do what you're doing. But in the real world here, we don't have that. So if I were a soldier and I was getting scared and somebody said, soldier, knock that off, that presumably would probably not do anything to my fear, but it might change my behavior a little bit. That's where I think that came from. It certainly didn't come from parenting. Because with parenting, we know that it's not going to be like that. Now, there is another side to this, which is that if you have a fearful dog and you comfort it, it should feel a little bit better. But if you want it to feel really a lot better, have them do something else. Change the subject. Do something that is going to make the dog have a good time. And that actually will work better. But it is a fallacy. You cannot operantly change an emotion if the emotion is already there. Always like the thing that I probably, you guys have already heard, if I'm in an airplane and I'm afraid of flying, mm-hmm. and I, you know, I start biting my nails, if somebody tries to make me feel better, is that going to make me feel any better and I'm afraid of flying? No. If they hit me, will it make me feel any better? No. I'm just going to hit them back. You know, might make me think of other things. But what they found with the fear of flying is if they give somebody something else to do, give them another job, then, you know, whatever it might be a puzzle or something else, then it becomes less invasive in their mind. So that's why it works kind of a lot better. So, you know, and we all like to cuddle dogs. Oh, good, Trish. What is that? Okay. Boy, okay. Intrinsically rewarding or non-rewarding behaviors. Whether you choose a food, a toy, or a life reward depends a lot on the behavior you're shaping. So for a wait at the door, going through the door is going to be enough of a reinforcement. For teaching a boring dog down, you might require a substantial reward given at intervals in order to keep the dog on point as to what it's supposed to be doing. And this, again, was something in the military-type training. What they would do is when the dog started to get up, they'd yell at the dog, and the dog would get back down again. But you can do it by flipping it, by giving the dog reinforcements every so often, which will accomplish the same thing and create a happier dog, which I think we're always all interested in doing, right, is creating a happier dog. Varying the dog will increase your dog's response. And some dogs actually require a little taste, a reinforcement sampler. And I didn't used to use that, and I use it all the time now. When I start a training session, I'll give the dog a treat and kind of go, I got more of these. There's more where this comes from. You just have to earn it. It's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, this one, and then we're going to be done. Okay, so timing in the delivery of your reward is critical at first. And I mean at first. It can be uncritical fairly quickly. So each reward has to come immediately after the behavior in order to be relevant to the dog. In the case of behaviors like sit-stay and down-stay, it can come during the behavior. In the case of a recall, it comes after the behavior is completed. But it has to come really fast or else the dog doesn't identify it with the behavior. But within almost minutes of working with a dog, you can start to delay the reward. And I remember there's a really famous clicker trainer, Kay Lawrence. She's really good. She's absolutely fantastic. She's British, and she comes out here every once in a while. She does a lot of horse clicker training. What she said is somebody at a seminar said, well, I understood that, you know, when you do the click, you have to do the treat right away. And she said, there's nothing saying you can't use that, draw that out, get some more anticipation in there. So if I'm teaching a dog something that is they don't know, that they're pretty naive about, I'm going to have that if I'm going to use clicker training, which I may or may not. I did with her. But then I'm probably going to be given that treat right on top of it. But probably within, I don't know, maybe third or fourth session, I'm starting to delay the rewards a lot to try to get more behaviors out of the dog because anticipation is so much fun. So what did I say? Your homework. Okay. Next week we're going to probably, because we didn't get to clicker training today, we're not going to do any of that. I want you to do the do as I do, right? So the name of the woman is Claudia Fugazza. Right? You want to see this? You don't want to see the video again, right? But you know what you're doing. You're going to have the dog sit, watch you. And then if the dog is primed for learning, this is a very reinforcing behavior. You already saw that with Aspen, right? Then you try to do something simple. It can be something like getting up on a stool, or I wouldn't say turning around. That's not usually very easy for dogs to understand. Touching something, I think the first thing I taught Aspen to do was to go up and touch the stump of a tree. So I did it with my hand and she did it with her nose. And then after that, it was jumping up on something. So without telling her to jump up, I would jump up and then get down. And so if you're gonna do the jumping up, you don't jump up and stay up there. You jump up, you get down, then you go back and then you say do it or whatever your cue is, and then they go over and do it. So this is why we know that it's observational learning, okay? And if you want, you can just do the one I was talking about at the very beginning. You know, have them jump over four things by walking over the four things, going to the end and causing them to jump over.
So you do that maybe twice, and then you do it, okay, watch, I'm going over this, like this, and then I'm gonna step out of the way, do it. So that's where you find out that the dog is actually learning by observation. It should be fun. Don't get too frustrated. No. But I would think it'd be a lot of fun.
Do treats come into that equation?
Oh yes, absolutely. If they do it, as soon as they do it. Not, okay. You're not gonna lure it. Okay, yeah. So you're not, okay. You, so this, yeah. this is all just watching you and learning that way. And I'm gonna be interested. This is the first time I've actually given this homework. So I'm gonna be very interested to see how well it works. And it might be hard to Bowden because I'm not sure he's got the focus. So puppies is gonna be harder with, although your pup has got a lot of focus, right?
She's really good.
Yeah, she's so she might be good. So yeah, good. I'm looking forward to it.
What are you gonna do?
That's, you know, seven dogs.
I'll line them up.
Yeah.
Which one's the smartest?
Yeah. But I mean, just think about how much fun it would be to do this a lot, right? Mm-hmm. To teach a dog this way a lot. Okay, was this okay?
Yeah.
All right, good. We'll see you next week, 11 o'clock.